clawing and scraping at the evidence to find a way to LaRue. They'd agreed to let the 960 agents make the arrest, but never expected that 960 would refuse to share the prize with the people who had handed it to them. Within the 960 group, Bailey's objections were viewed as the grumblings of an agent who hadn't been able to land the case. Minnesota hadn't handed them anything, they believed. They had started with a name and a file and ended with LaRue in custody. I'll be honest with you, I don't know if Kent Bailey knows what probable cause is, a former 960 agent told me. One of his big things was, well, your charge is just too simple. We have a much bigger project going. What's the old adage? How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Why go after an intergalactic conspiracy? Take a strategic strike. That was our thought. From my vantage point, hearing about it years later, the interagency grappling all seemed a little juvenile and counterproductive. Lost in the battles over what to do with LaRue, it seemed to me, was any real accounting for what he'd done and what he deserved. One thing was certain. The months and years that Bailey and Brill had pressed Linda Marks for an indictment that never came were now coming back to haunt them. I'm sorry your lawyers suck and mine don't, the SOD group supervisor told Bailey. A version of that conversation would repeat on a continuous loop over the coming weeks, after Brill and Bailey returned to Minnesota, denied a chance to sit across from their white whale. Those guys were already saying, it's national security, he can't talk to you, Bailey said. My ass, it's national security. As the agents back in New York were pumping LaRue for information, Brill was sitting on a pile of evidence accumulated over years of investigation. I said, come out and meet with her for a week. She's got all the books, Bailey said. Now he's talking, and they are going and looking up those names, and she already had them. She had lists of targets. The response, he said, was always the same. Thanks, nope. And they went out not knowing, because they wanted it to be their case. Everything that followed sprang from that decision, based on the hope that LaRue would deliver to the U.S. government something worth more than what they had, a multiple murderer, a prodigious global drug and arms trafficker, a solicitor of rogue regimes, and a man who had supplied hundreds of millions of doses of painkillers to its citizens. If he failed to deliver, Team America would be the ones getting played. While the agents in New York were recalibrating their plans for LaRue, the yacht Girovet was cruising across the Pacific with 200 kilos of cocaine and the DEA's tracker on board. Then, on October 5th, the tracking signal died. The 960 group thought the two shipmates might have discovered it, while Bailey assumed a more conventional explanation. Its battery had drained, perhaps due to the extra days the boat had spent idling off the coast of Peru. Either way, somewhere north of the Cook Islands in the South Pacific, the DEA lost the boat. The 960 agents handling LaRue had to make a call to the boat's satellite phone, hoping to reestablish its location. My car broke down, the captain told him. You have to send a car for me. Then LaRue called the captain's wife in Thailand, who told him, even more cryptically, that her husband called her to say he had been captured by the fish people. The 960 agents suspected he was perhaps being held by pirates. A massive hunt for the boat was soon underway. The DEA activated a system called the Pacific Transnational Crime Network, and authorities from the Cook Islands and Tonga were on the water, all looking for signs of the Girovet. But a storm was brewing in the region, further reducing the already long odds of finding one 44-foot yacht in the vastness of the South Pacific. On November 5, 2012, a pair of spear fishermen diving in southern Tonga spotted a yacht washed up on a shallow reef. The boat was lying on its side, salt water lapping against its red hull and broken tiller. A tattered French flag fluttered from a small flagpole at the stern. Its name was written in golden script across the back of the hull, Girovet. One of the divers climbed onto the clean white deck of the ship, a Sun Odyssey 44, and made a grisly discovery. At the helm was the badly decomposed body of a man, much of it picked away by seagulls. The divers fled the ship, climbed into their own boat, motored to the nearby port of Naifu, and called the local police. Bad weather rolled in, and the authorities couldn't return to the Girovet for 2 days. When they did, a group of Tongan officers examined it. Inside the hull, they took an axe to the interior walls and found a pile of clear garbage bags filled with neatly wrapped brown plastic bricks. Each contained a kilo of cocaine. All told, the boat had been carrying 204 kilos, worth more than $90 million on the street in Australia, where authorities suspected the drugs had been headed. It was the largest drug haul ever confiscated in the South Pacific. Tongan authorities identified the dead man as a 35-year-old Slovakian named Milan Rinzak. They found several passports on the ship, along with several hundred American dollars, over $1,000 worth of Dominican pesos, and a handful of Polish zloty. At first, the local police asserted that there was no foul play in Rynczak's death, but following an autopsy, they amended their assessment to cause of death inconclusive. He had been dead for days, if not weeks. No other body was ever located. For months afterward, the Tongan police tried to locate Rynczak's next of kin in Slovakia, but were unable to track down anyone who would claim him. As for Ivan Vaclavic, the man the DEA knew had been on the boat, his fate remained uncertain. An investigation by several Slovakian news outlets would soon reveal that Vaclavic was a cover identity of a man named Maros Dík, a Slovakian mobster who had disappeared from the country years earlier. He was rumored to have been fleeing for his life. Dík's brother was later shot dead back home. In 2011, a man resembling Dík had been stopped in Phuket, Thailand by local authorities. He was carrying a high-powered Bushmaster rifle that he said he'd bought in the Philippines, and a Thai Marine captain's license in Vaclavic's name. Now he seemed to have disappeared with the Gervé. Bailey, remembering the call that LaRue had been allowed to make to the boat, theorized that Vaclavic might have killed his fellow passenger, engineered a transfer off the boat, and left it to drift. He had blunt force trauma all over his head and body, Bailey said of the dead man. It could have been caused by the captain, or the boat. The former 960 Group agent I spoke with was confident about a different theory, albeit one that seemed to me to contain an equal amount of conjecture. Vaclavic, he said, had been captured by pirates at sea. I suggested that if that were so, perhaps the pirates had later set him free. Yeah, and I'm Santa Claus, he said. The Tongan authorities, for their part, seemed eager to put the mystery behind them and let the matter drop. They buried the sailor's remains in a local cemetery, overlooking the placid blue waters of a harbor called the Port of Refuge. In Minneapolis, Bailey and Brill still had an ongoing case to confront. Even if they'd lost control of LaRue himself, they continued to hold out hope of indicting him in Minnesota for his role as one of the biggest black market painkiller importers in history. And there was the rest of the RX Limited network to dismantle. In October 2012, they flew in LaRue's cousin, Matthew Smith, along with two other Zimbabweans, to testify in front of a grand jury. Each of them identified photos of LaRue to verify that he was on the surveillance tapes and images in Brazil. They described the web of companies like Wilex and Southern Ace that they had been sent to Hong Kong and elsewhere to create. Afterward, the investigators took the witnesses to a Vikings-Titans football game. Brill and Bailey had also coordinated with local DEA offices across the country to round up doctors and pharmacists who'd been some of the largest prescribers and suppliers in the network. Three RX Limited physicians, four affiliate website operators, and a pharmacist, arrested in New York and New Jersey, quickly entered guilty pleas. A housewife in Pennsylvania copped to forging a medical license and authorizing more than 15,000 prescriptions. She'd answered an ad for stay-at-home work on Craigslist. Babupai Patel, the Detroit-area pharmacist captured on the wiretap, was brought in on unrelated charges of massive healthcare fraud. But these were small targets, not the ones Brill and Bailey were most eager to arrest. They were after bigger fish like Moran Oz, Alon Berkman, and others higher up in the RX Limited chain of command. But arresting LaRue's lieutenants posed some of the same problems that capturing LaRue himself had. Moran Oz, Alon Berkman, and Omer Bezalel were living in Israel, whose government might prove resistant to extradition. Most of the crimes they had supposedly committed weren't crimes under Israeli law. Lachlan McConnell and Shai Reuven were both still in Manila, living under a Philippine government that had so far proven less than fully cooperative. To capture these guys, Brill and Bailey needed to lure them somewhere else. And to do that, they needed LaRue. The 960 Group, however, was focused on putting LaRue to work in their own sting operations against the likes of Joseph Hunter. They allowed him only enough communication with his RX Limited employees and enough access to his bank accounts to keep the network barely alive. For Felix Clausen, LaRue's arrest meant an abrupt and disorienting end to the project that had consumed his life. For nearly a year, he'd spent most of his waking moments thinking about how to convince LaRue that he was bringing him the deal of a lifetime, constantly vigilant to any slip-up that could expose the ruse. Now he spent weeks in a Marriott in Arlington, Virginia, video chatting with his fiancée, idling while the Justice Department worked through their arrangement with LaRue and determined whether they needed Clausen as a witness. He was elated that it had all worked, but unsure how to feel about the deal LaRue was striking and where the story might go now that he had exited it. I came to know a version of the same feeling years later. I'd never been face-to-face with LaRue, never tried to sell him a story and risked his wrath, but I could certainly claim a similar obsession with trying to understand him. It had chewed up years of my life as I tried to wrestle the facts to fit a simpler frame, something with a cleaner ending, a story I could hold in my head all at once. In that version of the story, LaRue's arrest was the close of his saga, justice done. But the maddening contradictions of LaRue's world were part of what had hooked me in the first place, which is why I knew the story wasn't over yet. This wasn't the end of the game, just a reshuffling of the teams. Chapter 29. The Stings. 2012 to 2013. Back in the game. News from the boss. The Colombians arrive. The perfect hit. History repeats. In a typical organized crime case, authorities work their way up a kind of pyramid, flipping lower-level participants to inform against the lieutenants above them, flipping those lieutenants to inform against bosses, sacrificing small-scale prosecutions in order to pursue powerful figures at the apex. With LaRue, the DEA had captured the man who not only sat atop the organization, but the one who had created it, from his own mind, and ran it with ruthless specificity. LaRue was not just the most powerful force behind the company, or RX Limited, or any of a dozen names the organization traveled under. He was the company. The U.S. Department of Justice might have touted that triumph. They might have chosen to prosecute LaRue to the fullest extent of the law, as they had done with similarly high-profile cases like Victor Boots, and then publicly celebrated their almost certain victory in federal court. But now they decided to invert the pyramid, working their way to the base, cloaked in a blanket of secrecy. Instead of allowing the organization LaRue had built to quietly disintegrate from neglect, they would use him to hold it together as they pursued the underlings whom he had drawn into it. In legal circles, this was known as cooperating down, and LaRue would prove an enthusiastic participant. The speed of his transformation from target to informant was breathtaking. "It was obvious that my situation was a bad situation," was all he would say, with a shrug, when asked later why he'd flipped so easily. Within a day of his arrival in New York, he signed what's known as a proffer agreement. Under the terms of a proffer, LaRue was free to talk to prosecutors without fear. Nothing he told them could be used against him. Whatever he truthfully fessed up to couldn't result in new charges against him. Any lies or omissions, on the other hand, could. Suddenly the man whom Kimberly Brill and Kent Bailey had worked for years to understand was spilling parts of his story to investigators as fast as they could record them. He was cagey at first about some of the killings he'd ordered. "I'm already at risk of being sentenced to death in the Philippines," he said later in court, perhaps fearing a kind of extrajudicial justice since the Philippines banned the death penalty in 2006. But eventually he came clean on 7 murders. He admitted to bribing officials in the Philippines, China, Laos, Brazil, and all over Africa, to laundering hundreds of millions of dollars, to dealing in massive quantities of methamphetamines and cocaine, to selling explosives to and acquiring weapons from Iran. The SOD agents who had cornered LaRue, Eric Stouch and Thomas Sindrick, needed more than just names and admissions. To run him as an asset, they'd need to quickly convince his remaining crew that LaRue was still at large, running his business. "We were trying to maintain the image that he was still free and moving about, specifically in Brazil," Stouch later said. The 960 group also had indicted Shai Reuven in the methamphetamine sting. He'd been scheduled to travel to Liberia with LaRue, but failed to show up. And now the agents left him on the street to help maintain the myth that LaRue was still free. To work with LaRue, the agents needed a judge's approval to pull him out of confinement, after which they would transport him to one of a few locations that now comprised his world. A DEA office near JFK Airport, the U.S. Attorney's offices at the federal courthouse in downtown Manhattan, or the Airport Hilton. In one inexplicable security slip, someone allowed LaRue's record to be publicly available on the Bureau of Prisons website. Paul LaRue, without the space, was listed as released on 9/4/2013, perhaps an artifact of the process of moving him in and out of jail. Once sequestered, LaRue would spend the day orchestrating a new set of sting operations. He attacked his role with the single-minded devotion that he'd previously shown toward his criminal endeavors. There was one immediate problem. LaRue communicated largely using email that had passed through his own server, fastfreeemail.com, which he had designed to periodically destroy his messages. The agents needed a way to mirror the contents of that email address in another account so that they could preserve all of LaRue's communications as evidence. Fortunately, there was one person in the room technically proficient enough to execute such a maneuver, and he seemed happy to be back in the game, even if on the other side. From inside the confines of the Manhattan Federal Courthouse, LaRue logged in to his old fast-free email server in the Philippines and got to work. From the perspective of his employees scattered around the world, LaRue had briefly gone dark, but not for long enough to raise alarms. They were used to not seeing him for months at a time. You could always reach him via email or phone, and that was probably the strangest thing of all when he dropped off for a while, said Tim Benvakias, who had rejoined the organization when Joseph Hunter took over LaRue's kill teams. Benvakias's new job was to run an operation to import tramadol, the generic version of Ultram, directly from Mexican cartels into Texas, foregoing the RX Limited pharmacies. The fact that people's daily duties resumed, along with pay, helped the mystery go unnoticed, he said. In retrospect, it was extreme naivete on all of our parts. In December, Hunter suddenly began receiving a flurry of calls and encrypted notes from LaRue, writing from an old address he rarely used, john@fastfreeemail.com. LaRue told Hunter that he was working on a new project, a big one, that would need him to be at the top of his game. It involved a group he would refer to only as the South American Partners. As a first step, LaRue wanted Hunter, operating under the names Jim Riker and Ja Rule, and using his old rambo@fastfreeemail.com address, to assemble a team of skilled, reliable ex-military men who could handle specialist jobs. Hunter didn't need him to elaborate. Hunter sent word to, among others, his old partner Chris DeMeyer, who along with Daddy Mac had quit the organization after the Edelor murder, that he was seeking new guys. DeMeyer declined to rejoin, but put the call out to his own network, and soon resumes of prospective new security team members were arriving over the transom. From Manila to Cape Town, other members and former members of the company were also hearing from LaRue, who seemed rejuvenated and ready to launch an array of new ventures. Among the first was Marcus, the South African who had been LaRue's personal assassin. In early 2013, LaRue proposed he take on a project in America. He reopened my email account, Marcus said, and paid money to my bank account. When Marcus balked at traveling to the States, LaRue was ready with another idea. Marcus could organize a group of ex-military guys to work in Somalia. LaRue also suggested that he would retain Marcus again as an assassin, this time to murder Ari Ben Menashe, the Israeli whom he'd once employed to help procure land and a diplomatic passport in Zimbabwe. In another strange development that the DEA never quite parsed, the real Ben Menashe reached out to LaRue, saying he'd heard that LaRue was in trouble. Ben Menashe suggested LaRue take harbor in Israel and work with the Mossad. I can give you protection, he told LaRue, according to the former 960 agent. The agents decided to ignore the offer. Marcus went so far as to send LaRue the resumes of possible recruits, but then the correspondence abruptly ended. Only years later, Marcus said, did I realize that this fucking cunt was in jail, trying to set me up to come there. The phenomenon replicated itself across LaRue's operations. Scott Stammers, the security contractor who worked for LaRue in Thailand, heard from him again in late 2012. Stammers was a 34-year-old British citizen born in Hong Kong, who somehow retained his English pallor despite years of living in a tropical climate. He had helped coordinate gun and drug-related operations for LaRue in the past, and was skilled at sourcing everything from heavy weaponry to methamphetamine precursor chemicals and the cooks to prepare them. LaRue wanted Stammers, together with Philip Shackles, a tattooed Irishman who had become central to LaRue's drug business, forging relationships with South American cartels, to coordinate the logistics for a meth deal. This time it would be for some new associates in Colombia, where he'd previously failed to find the right connection. He said, I won't be in the Philippines for a while. It's gotten too hot here, Stammers recalled. My partners want to meet you in Thailand. The deal, as LaRue described it, would be a replay of one he'd done before, with Yi Tiong Tan Lim, who'd previously arranged the company's acquisition of nearly 50 kilos of meth in 2012. Lim, a balding Chinese man in his 50s with wire-rimmed glasses, purportedly operated an import-export business, but maintained ties to a triad group in Hong Kong. To get to Lim as part of his new DEA duties, LaRue reached out to Kelly Peralta, a 39-year-old Filipino who had once worked for him as a manager of his bar in Manila. Peralta's role in the company had been negligible, at best. Dave Smith had hired him to work at Sid's, LaRue's bar, after meeting him at the Blue Rock Resort in Subic. After Sid's closed 2 years later, Peralta came to LaRue with an offer, an introduction to Lim, whose triad connections could get LaRue high-quality meth out of North Korea. Peralta, who spoke English better than Lim, had become the go-between with LaRue, for which he was paid $25,000. Now, 1 year later, LaRue was back, asking him to make the same arrangement, this time for the South Americans. Peralta agreed to do it. In early January 2013, Lim and Peralta traveled to Thailand to meet the South Americans, who claimed to be senior figures in a Colombian cartel. They were planning to sell the meth in New York, they said. First, they'd need a sample sent to Liberia so they could test the quality. The whole plan was a modified version of the sting used to ensnare LaRue himself. The request was a little unusual, but it didn't faze Lim any more than it had fazed LaRue. "My boss," Lim said, "only gets it from the original source." That source was North Korea. North Korea's contribution to the international meth trade dated to the mid-1990s, when heavy rains wiped out its thriving poppy crop, opening a lane for lab-made drugs. By 2007, North Korea was producing tons of the stuff per year, the highest quality product for export, according to one U.S. congressional report, which was then smuggled across the border into northeastern China. By 2013, the flow of drugs out of the dictatorship seemed to be lessening. The State Department observed that state-sponsored drug trafficking may have ceased or been sharply reduced, or the DPRK regime has become more adept at concealing state-sponsored trafficking of illegal drugs. Lim now made a similar point to the Colombians. "The North Korean government already burned all the labs," he told them, "to show the Americans they aren't selling it anymore." But Lim said he still had access to roughly 1 ton of ultra-pure North Korean meth. "Only our labs are not closed," he said. The Colombians asked to visit the labs to verify its origins. If the DEA was going to use LaRue to get a foothold inside North Korea's drug production, they would presumably need Lim to give them access. But Lim deflected them, arguing that non-Korean speakers would raise suspicions. The next month, Lim provided 2 small meth samples to Peralta, who delivered them to Philip Shackles. Together with Stammers, he shipped the samples via FedEx to Monrovia, hidden inside a photo album. Stammers emailed the tracking number to LaRue. The Colombians reported back to Stammers that the 2 samples had tested at 96 and 98% pure, respectively. "I just received the following on the 2 samples, Stammers then informed LaRue. A. Wider and in smaller granules. B. Clear and bigger shards and harder to break. As per the boys, they are both very good and very strong, but they preferred B." The deal was on. By March 2013, Joseph Hunter had spent several months collecting and sorting resumes for mercenaries in Poland, Germany, and South Africa. He forwarded his top picks to LaRue for approval. Together, they settled on 3 men. None had worked for the company before. Now they would be unwittingly working for its DEA-constructed mirage. Dennis Gogol was a 27-year-old German whose life followed the path of so many of the other contractors who had joined LaRue over the years. He had been raised by his grandmother in Stadagen, a small city in northern Germany, after his mother died of asthma and his father abandoned him. He joined the army, he said, to take control of his life. He'd served in an elite unit deployed for peacekeeping in Kosovo. On his discharge in 2010, he'd shifted into private security, first in Afghanistan and then working as an anti-piracy specialist on boats threatened by Somali pirates. His Facebook profile consisted largely of photos of him posing with weapons or working shirtless on the decks of ships. On one of these missions, a fellow contractor told him about a well-paying job involving a highly specialized security group to protect and secure high-profile clients. He gave Gogol an email address, and Gogol sent off his CV to Joseph Hunter. A few days later, he got an email back. "Got it," Hunter said. "You're definitely in." Next, Gogol connected Hunter with another former German soldier he'd served with, a high school dropout named Michael Filter, who had also left the service in 2010. With young twin daughters to support, Filter had jumped at the prospect of a job that paid well, for a client that Gogol said, "You don't want to know the details about." Filter saw it as a possibility to do something useful and be able to provide for his girls properly, his sister recalled. The third team member, Sławomir Saborski, was a Polish ex-policeman. He'd worked for 15 years in law enforcement, including 5 spent protecting the Polish president, and would later claim to have provided protection for President George W. Bush and Pope John Paul II. He, too, had drifted into contract work, including a stint in the French Foreign Legion, but struggled to make ends meet. In February, Saborski received Hunter's job solicitation from a friend in the Foreign Legion and wrote to Hunter directly. "I am convinced that my experience, commitment, and professionalism, confirmed by my references, will lead to the success of your company and mutual satisfaction," he said. His resume included such qualifications as sniper, close combat specialist, and parachutist. With the 3 recruits, Hunter felt they were ready to get to work for the South Americans. He wrote to LaRue that Saborski and Gogol in particular were highly qualified individuals that will get a lot of stuff done for us. In March, Hunter traveled to Phuket, Thailand, and met LaRue's South African contacts at one of LaRue's houses, a stucco ranch with a red terracotta roof near the Loch Palm Golf Club. Gogol, Siborski, and Filter arrived for their first in-person meeting. Hunter had told them to dress like tourists for the trip, nothing military police-looking, and had wired them expense money for their tickets. Once everyone was present, Hunter, dressed in a Batman t-shirt and cargo shorts, gathered them around the kitchen table. None of them noticed the small video camera mounted inside what looked like an electric junction box in the ceiling, installed by a DEA technician a few days earlier and feeding into a DVD recorder hidden in the panel above it. The DVR in turn was connected to the internet, transmitting the crew's discussions to a team of local Thai police and DEA agents. Hunter, projecting the authority of an experienced commander, disclosed the identities of the two clients, two men from a Colombian cartel, associates of Hunter's boss, whom he referred to as Benny. "You're going to see tons of cocaine," Hunter told them. "You're going to see millions of dollars. You're going to see gold." The team's work, he said, could include surveillance and counter-surveillance of drug shipments, collecting money from people who hadn't paid the Colombians, and carrying cocaine. "There's bonus work," Hunter said. "It's assassinations. So if you're interested in that, you can do it. If you're not interested, you don't have to." A minor assassination, he estimated, might earn someone $25,000, with the price escalating depending on the threat level. Regardless, the three of them would be joining a rarefied group. "Once a mission is received, that mission becomes sacred to you," Hunter said. "You will accomplish it to the end, at all costs." For the next hour, Hunter delivered a sermon extolling mercenary life under the boss, pausing only for the occasional "yeah" from his team. "It's just like a military mission," he said. "You see James Bond in the movie and you're saying, 'Oh, I can do that?' Well, you're going to do it now. Everything you see or you've thought about, you're going to do. It's real, and it's up to you." Hunter's soliloquy wandered from dramatic recounting of his own exploits to detailed instructions on kidnappings and assassinations. "That one year we killed 9 people," he said. "We hand-grenaded the people's houses. We, not kidnapped a guy, but we conned him to come with us. We put him in the ocean, shot at him. He gave us the money back. Assassinated people. What else we did? We smuggled gold. We smuggled weapons." "You gotta use your head," he continued. "If you gotta kidnap somebody to recover funds, you know how you gotta plan a kidnapping, right? You knock the guy out in your minivan or your SUV. You already gonna have a place to hide, right? A place to hold him. You just gotta drive there and get to the place. And then once he's inside the building, it's no problem. You're gonna handcuff him and all that shit, and then I'm sure he's gonna give you the money, right? Or arrange for the money right away. If you have to waterboard him, it's easy. You just put a wet towel on his face and pour water on him about, 15 to 20 seconds till he talks." The next day, the Colombians arrived at the house. The cartel representatives met individually with each member to make sure that everyone understood the expectations. "You do whatever you have to do," one of the Colombians said. "If we call you and say, 'This fucking guy ain't gonna pay,' that's it. We want you to be magicians. You disappear people." Hunter's crew moved into villas in Phuket, where Hunter ordered them to stay in shape while awaiting the next assignment. To his younger charges, he appeared introverted, often sullen, but he also sometimes offered the mentorship of a senior officer, a seasoned veteran with 1,000 stories and an eye for all the angles. "Hunter and I built a strong bond as he took me under his wing," Gogol later said. "After a short while, our relationship expanded, and I began to view Hunter not only as a mentor, but as a father figure, something I never had before." The DEA now had 2 sets of targets on the hook, the North Korean meth group and Hunter's team, but Sindrick and Stouch were careful not to reel them in too fast. For Hunter's team, the Colombians first offered up purposefully pedestrian jobs, like conducting surveillance at a distance on a large shipment of drugs in a Thai port. Next, the Colombians dispatched them to Mauritius, an island nation in the Indian Ocean just east of Madagascar, to provide security for a meeting. Here, the two groups of DEA targets would cross paths for the first time. Scott Stammers and Philip Shackles were there, at LaRue's direction, to negotiate weapons purchases for the Colombians, who said they wanted to buy surface-to-air missiles. Hunter's team was brought for security. The following day, Stammers, Shackles, and the Colombians met with a pair of actual drug dealers, Serbians, who were offering to help replace the cocaine lost on the Jerove. The Serb crew, as Stammers reported to LaRue, could supply 700 to 1,000 kilos in South America for a shipment to Australia. Sindrick and Stouch, stationed nearby to monitor the proceedings, watched their already complex operation mushroom into something that required an organizational chart to follow. Besides their faux Colombian cartel bosses and their five targets, Gogol, Filter, Siborski, Stammers, and Shackles, the April meetings involved 10 other criminals who weren't even subjects of their investigation. The chances that someone would find a hole in the sting operation mushroomed with every new mark that showed up. But as he had in his real business, LaRue had little problem juggling operations. He would call multiple times a day to check in on their progress, pressing his employees to hurry things up. None of them seemed to find it unusual. LaRue told Shackles that the organization had suffered huge losses, and that moving the North Korean meth should be his top priority. In mid-May, Stammers and Shackles returned to Thailand to meet with the Colombians about the logistics of the meth shipment. Shackles, for his part, appeared to be struggling to keep it together. "You seem tense," one of the Colombians said during a meeting. "Of course, I'm fucking stressed," Shackles said. At one point, Shackles' hands were shaking so badly he spilled a cup of water on one of the supposed cartel bosses. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" the Colombian said. "You need to stay cool. Just relax." In meetings with Lim and Peralta, meanwhile, the Colombians set the amounts and price of the shipments, proposing an initial 60 kilos of meth at $60,000 per. "My friends, can you do the 60? A little bit, a little more, like 100? Peralta asked. The Colombians agreed, and over the summer months, the groups hammered out the details. In emails about the arrangement, they referred to the drugs as car parts. Now it was LaRue, the informant, who had his targets eating out of his hand, just as Felix Clausen had once duped him. After Mauritius, Hunter proposed to LaRue that they add Tim Vanvakias to his crew. Now 41, Vanvakias had been back in the company since 2012, stationed at a stash house in Texas. For $7,500 a month, he guarded a large supply of contraband tramadol, the generic version of Ultram, awaiting shipment to buyers on the East Coast. Hunter thought Vanvakias could be put to better use on the security team. LaRue agreed to a transfer and a raise to $10,000 a month, as long as Vanvakias was willing to engage in bonus work. Stouch and Cindric had planned out the stings so that they intersected just enough with LaRue's actual business to seem real. And now, after months of slowly establishing that authenticity, the agents began to spring the trap. It was time to begin offering the security team bonus work. In an email, LaRue informed Hunter that he and the Colombians had found a snitch in their organization, a boat captain who had tipped off the DEA and Australian Federal Police to the Gervé. From John, john@fastfreeemail.com, to Jim Riker, Mr. Tiberius 2@yahoo.com, sent Thursday, May 30th, 2013, 12:50 a.m., subject, re. "The situation is our contact in the FBI in Ecuador has been looking into the Gervé incident for us. The man who is responsible has been providing tips to the DEA and AFP. He is a boat captain that is working for us. He does jobs for us mainly in the Caribbean and Africa. He was the one who handled the Gervé for us and leaked the info to the U.S. agent. Him and a particular agent are problems for us. This is a priority job that will pay a lot of money. I need your suggestion on the best way to handle it. I need your input on what is needed to fix this issue ASAP, as we already lost 3 shipments at a lot of money. Please be advised he does not know anyone except his handler, but he knows some of our boats, so we need to get this issue resolved before we lose more money. Is this something your team can handle? Or should I assign it to my South African guys? The jobs will probably be in Africa, as the captain is based there." "My guys will handle it," Hunter replied. "Are you talking about both the captain and the agent, or just the captain?" "Both are a problem. Both need to be handled," LaRue said. "Informer is $200,000 and $500,000 for the agent. Hunter would get $100,000 for organizing the hit." "They will handle both jobs," Hunter said. "They just need good tools." In a later email to LaRue, he elaborated on exactly what tools they would require. From Jim Riker, Mr. Tiberius 2@yahoo.com, to john@fastfreeemail.com. "Hey, here is a list of items needed for the job. It includes everything that they can think of, because they don't exactly know the plan and how it will be executed. That's why it's so much. 2 submachine guns with silencers, MAC-10, MP5, P90, MP7, something small. Magazines for the weapons. 2 22 pistols with silencers. These are a must. Magazines and ammo for these. 1 308 rifle with scope and case for it. Ammo for it. 2 level 3A concealment vests. 2 GPSs for the evac, one for each guy. 2 black guy masks, like the ones we have, but already in country. 2 two-way radios, preferably with earpieces and push-to-talk capability. two motorcycles, at least 250cc, with helmets that have a black tinted visor, two cars or SUVs with tinted windows, stolen license plates for both motorcycles and cars. Once they are in place and have a plan, additional items might be required depending on the assessment. At the same time, the Colombians had a new task for the security team, one that for the first time would put them in the sights of American drug laws. This time the job was in the Bahamas, keeping watch on a private plane as it was loaded with 300 kilos of cocaine for delivery to the United States. The team, now consisting of Gogol, Filter, Siborski, and Vimbakias, with Hunter coordinating operations from Thailand, arrived in June for what seemed like a leisurely gig. Siborski posed for photos on the beach, shirtless and holding a drink and a cigar. They scouted out a surveillance location behind a chain-link fence, off a runway at the Nassau airport, and watched through a car window as bags of cocaine were loaded onto a small private plane they were told was headed for New York. After seeing off the plane, Vimbakias met with the Colombians at a hotel to discuss the upcoming bonus jobs. They had brought along photographs and dossiers on the DEA agent and snitch, as well as information on the location. They wanted the job done in Liberia. On August 15th, 2013, Hunter's team met with the two cartel representatives one last time in Thailand to finalize arrangements for the assassination. Even though they'd worked together for 8 months, Hunter had the Colombians searched, took their electronic devices, and insisted that the meeting be held outdoors as an extra precaution against being recorded. Hunter, Gogol, Vimbakias, and the Colombians, who by this point had paid Hunter a $480,000 down payment for the murders of the DEA agent and snitch, reviewed the assassination plan step by step. Siborski and Filter had been deemed unready for bonus work. They traveled instead to Estonia to provide security on a staged weapons deal. The crew studied photos of the intended hits, discussing how to enter and leave Liberia undetected. Gogol and Vimbakias would have both cars and motorcycles at their disposal. Hunter had purchased the black guy masks mentioned in his email, latex masks from a Hollywood special effects store, specially designed to conceal the wearer's race. They'd tried them on, Gogol said, and even when they closed their eyes, the masks were blinking with us, even with real hairs and everything. That's perfect stuff. Gogol would command the operation. You run the show, one of the Colombians told him, and suggested they could make the job look like a robbery. I think we'll probably have to get up close to him, Vimbakias noted. You know what I mean? To make sure it gets done. Among the weapons that Hunter had suggested, they settled on German-made MP7 machine guns with the power to pierce some bulletproof vests. That'll guarantee whatever gets in that kill zone goes down, Vimbakias said. The Colombians would then help them get out of the country. I'm glad you're going to be part of the extraction stuff, Vimbakias told them. The job's not the headache. It's getting in and out. On September 24th, 2013, everything was in place for both missions. The meth was set to leave the Philippines by container, and Lim and Peralta convened at a hotel in Phuket to await its arrival. All the main players are now on the ground, Stammers emailed LaRue, as he, Shackles, and Adrian Valkovic, a member of a local motorcycle club who had signed on as the deputy ground commander for the meth shipment, handling security, sat down for a final planning session. Standing by for meet coordinates and time. The coordinates never came. Instead, heavily armed commandos from Thailand's Narcotics Suppression Bureau swept in a few hours later and arrested the five men. Meanwhile, Hunter was at LaRue's nearby Lokbom villa, awaiting updates on the Liberia assassination job. He was alone and unarmed when a dozen officers from NSB arrived, led by the deputy police commissioner. They handcuffed him and led him outside, then sat him on the ground by the front door while police officials posed for photos beside him. In images that would soon run in newspapers around the world, Hunter appeared almost expressionless, staring into the cameras with his hands cuffed behind his back. He was dressed in cargo shorts and a t-shirt with a Springfield Unathletic Department logo and an image of a drooling Homer Simpson asleep on a couch. 5,000 miles away, Siborski and Filter were picked up by local authorities at a hotel in Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. The men were transported to a former Soviet prison. The cops roughed up Siborski enough that he would later require abdominal surgery. That same morning, Vimbakias and Gogol stepped off a plane at Roberts International Airport outside Monrovia, ready to assassinate the DEA agent and the snitch. The Colombians were supposed to meet them as they got off the plane, ready with the weapons, masks, and vehicles. Instead, the Liberian police were waiting, and the would-be assassins were quickly transferred into DEA custody and flown back to New York. It was a year to the day since Paul LaRue had made the same trip, with the same result. 2 days later, Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, held a press conference in Manhattan to announce the success of the Hunter operation. The bone-chilling allegations in today's indictment read like they were ripped from the pages of a Tom Clancy novel, he said gravely. The charges tell a tale of an international band of mercenary marksmen who enlisted their elite military training to serve as hired guns for evil ends. Paul LaRue's name and role went unmentioned. Chapter 30. The investigators, the operators, the pharmacist, the mercenaries, the reporter. 2013 to 2015. An audience with LaRue. Oz hears from the boss. A rendezvous in Romania. A knock at Timpati's door. Under pressure in North Carolina. Lachlan McConnell on the run. Kent Bailey and Kimberly Brill were finally granted a chance to sit down with LaRue, albeit with restrictions, in November 2012. They left their Minneapolis offices at the DEA and flew back to New York. As they sat waiting for LaRue's arrival in the fifth floor room of the Manhattan courthouse, Brill was nervous, not knowing what to expect from the man she'd been circling for more than 5 years. When he was escorted in, LaRue was polite but guarded at first, seemingly unhappy with the prospect of another quizzing. He'd already begun working on the Joseph Hunter sting operation as part of the 960 team, and now here was a woman from Minnesota with an empty notepad and hours of new questions. But gradually, he seemed to realize that he was talking to the only person who knew as much about his pharmacy operation as he did. Brill had analyzed it from every angle, traced every branch to its endpoint. And she had read his emails, too. For Brill, it soon felt like they were talking as peers. "I don't know that I would call it fun," she said, "but it was somebody I could actually talk to who knew what I was talking about the whole time, where I didn't have to explain." Every question she'd had about RX Limited can now be answered by the man who had created it. They dove deep into the technical aspects of LaRue's networks, the email servers, the affiliate website backends, the thousands of web domains. After a couple hours, Brill had filled the notepad and was writing on its cardboard backing. Over the course of late 2012 and early 2013, Brill returned to interview LaRue several more times. She and Bailey had hoped to utilize him as an asset, to help lure Moran Oz, Alon Berkman, and others out of Israel. But the 960 agents who controlled LaRue had specific targets in their sights, Hunter and the North Korean meth groups, and declined to make him available to help Brill round up her own. LaRue was permitted to send only occasional communications to the likes of Oz and Berkman, just enough to keep up the charade that he was at large. After Hunter was busted in the fall of 2013, Bailey and Brill finally got a chance to put LaRue to work. Brill found him to be an enthusiastic partner in setting up a new ruse. "He had made up his mind that he was going to do as much as he could now that he was in the situation he was in," Brill said, "and information was his currency." This time, LaRue wouldn't have Colombian partners to dangle in front of the targets. He would have to use cleverness and cajoling to lure Oz and Berkman into a trap. With RX Limited barely functional, first he would have to convince them that he was bringing it back to life. On orders from LaRue when he was still a free man, Oz and Berkman had shuttered the Tel Aviv office in 2012. They spent months selling off furniture and equipment. From Brazil, LaRue had ordered Berkman to transfer as many of his assets as possible out of Hong Kong, where the government was trying to seize them. Oz and Berkman retrenched to Jerusalem, a temporary setback, LaRue assured them. He was planning a future iteration of the business with new call centers, new pharmacies, new doctors. But his communication became increasingly sporadic. Periodically, Oz wrote to LaRue to ask about severance payments for former employees in Israel. As the company wound down, LaRue had wired part of the money, which was owed under Israeli law, and promised that the rest would come later. And then, in September 2012, LaRue seemed to disappear entirely. Rumors swirled that he had gone underground because authorities had intercepted one of his boats, carrying arms or drugs. Shai Reuven, who was still running LaRue's business in Manila, would say only that the boss had gone quiet. The transfers from Hong Kong and the other accounts became increasingly sporadic. "We knew something had happened," Oz said. In March 2013, LaRue reappeared, with orders for Oz and Berkman to further cut the staff in Israel, and to stop filling orders and paying doctors and pharmacists by the end of the year. The company would relaunch again soon, he now said, with a new office in Eastern Europe and a different model. "Please advise, what is the status with the severance payments?" Oz wrote back. "You asked me to split it to three, but the people didn't get their second payment and keep calling me. Please let me know what to tell them." Oz still felt responsible to the Israeli employees who were owed money, some of whom were friends, and none of whom had heard of Paul LaRue. To them, Oz was the boss. He was getting phone calls from employees saying, "You shut down the company. You disappeared. You have to pay us by law," a friend of Oz's said. In late December, Oz and Berkman stumbled onto an article in the Brazilian newspaper, Folha de São Paulo, reporting that LaRue had been arrested. The story, by a reporter who had been tipped off to the Brazilian end of the investigation, was published in Portuguese, but a quick pass through an online translator provided the basic, alarming facts. The DEA had been investigating RX Limited for years and had tracked LaRue to Brazil, where he was involved in large-scale cocaine trafficking across the Pacific. Worse, the article claimed that the DEA had arrested LaRue in Liberia and he'd cut a deal, which led to the arrest of employees in Australia, Hong Kong, Philippines, and the United States. The headline was simply, "The Lord of Crime." In a panic, Oz left word with Reuven to call him. The next day, the return call came from LaRue himself. "I heard you guys are getting very excited over this article that appeared in the Brazilian press," he said, laughing. "Yes, tell me about it," Oz said. "At the end of the day, the Israelis are the guys they arrested in Hong Kong," LaRue said. "Basically, they were grabbed and accused of money laundering." "Yeah. Bottom line, most of that article is actually true, but it's been grossly exaggerated and distorted, okay? There's always surveillance on our operations. That is a matter of fact." "Mm-hmm. And also, that's a big part of the reason why I shut down the old operation, like, when I did. Because there's a lot of heat on it." "Yeah, but everything is okay with you?" "Everything is okay with me," LaRue said. "Right now I'm traveling under a different passport. I took some steps. You following what I'm saying?" "Of course." "For some reason, the press likes to write about me. I am the lord of crime in this Brazilian newspaper. I run huge militias. You know, they love to write all types of bullshit. Some of it is true, but most of it is grossly exaggerated," he said. "You know, everyone needs to calm the fuck down." LaRue told Oz he finally had the rest of the money for the Israeli employees, coming within weeks. And he still planned to start the company again. "I know you're hurting," he said. "Keep in mind, everyone is fucking hurting right now. You see what I'm saying? But there is light at the end of the tunnel. I have arranged your cash." He just needed to see Oz in person to finalize the transfer. He first proposed they meet in Panama, but Oz declined. When LaRue suggested Romania, he agreed. With the benefit of hindsight, it seemed absurd that Oz had fallen for it. Berkman didn't, electing to ignore LaRue's entreaties and stay in Israel. Was it greed that blinded Oz, or gullibility? His emails made him appear enthusiastic to restart the business with LaRue, but later he would assert that the only reason he'd gone along with the meeting was in the hopes of getting the employee's severance back. "I didn't go to Romania to get my own salary," he said. In another sense, though, it was a testament to the alternate reality, mythology even, that LaRue had created around himself. He could have an employee thrown off a boat and shot at, show up in a UN report funding a militia in Somalia, get written up in a major newspaper as having been busted for drug running, and an employee would still believe him enough to get on a plane and meet him in a foreign country. A few weeks later, Oz landed in Bucharest along with a friend he'd invited on the trip. They had an Israeli expat friend in Romania, and the three of them spent 2 days hanging out and gambling in the local casinos. Oz won a few thousand euros at his preferred game, roulette. The meeting with LaRue was scheduled for the third day, but as the time approached, Oz grew nervous. His chief concern was not that LaRue might be setting him up, but that he might be planning to kill him. He asked the friend from Bucharest to arrange some hired security, just to make sure there are no surprises. The friend found a couple of bodyguards he could pay by the hour. LaRue had set the meeting for March 13th at the Pullman Hotel, not far from the airport. Oz and his two friends arrived in the morning and met up with the bodyguards, who accompanied Oz to a distant part of the lobby while his friends waited at the entrance. After a half hour, Oz texted them to say the boss hadn't shown up yet. When the friends checked in a while later, Oz didn't respond. Worried, they decided to look for him. They found him at another entrance, surrounded by several men and one woman. Oz explained that they were plainclothes police officers, that they'd shown up looking for him, and wanted to take him to the station to ask questions. The bodyguards seemed to have slipped away. The officers asked the friends to accompany them to the station, and the three men climbed into the back of an old unmarked car. Oz seemed terrified that it was another of LaRue's ruses. "Look, they don't wear police uniforms," Oz said to his friends in Hebrew. "I hope it's not one of his tricks." He was relieved when they arrived at the Bucharest police station. At least it appeared not to be a LaRue hit in disguise. His local friend found him a Romanian lawyer, while the other one went to their hotel to retrieve their passports, hoping the whole thing could be cleared up by the evening. After the friend returned, the lawyer told him that Oz had been arrested on behalf of an American agency. "Go back to Israel, meet Moran's parents, and tell them to get a good lawyer," the attorney told him, "because they are going to move him to the U.S. for a trial." Oz spent the next several months in an overcrowded Romanian jail, housed with seven other inmates in a stifling 7-by-10-foot cell. One of his cellmates had a heart attack and died. Oz's family hired a local lawyer to fight his extradition, but the hearings were all conducted in Romanian, and Oz often had little idea what was happening. His only contact with the American government had been through Kimberly Brill from the DEA, who briefly showed up to question him after his arrest. More than anything, he was baffled that the United States had used LaRue to get to him and not the other way around. He told them about how LaRue had ordered him thrown off the boat and shot at. He would have helped them, he said, if they'd asked. Finally, on the last day he could be legally held in Romania, a judge overruled Oz's opposition to extradition, and he was put on a plane to the United States. He landed in Minneapolis and was transported to the Sherburne County Jail outside the city. In early 2014, Prabhakara Tempati was hustling again to keep his head above water. He'd opened 3 sleep clinics, and 2 of them were losing money. To help make ends meet, he was picking up call shifts at a hospital near his home in suburban Philadelphia. It had been 2 years since he had given up prescribing for Rx Limited. More recently, his referral fees had stopped coming as well, and his physician contacts, still prescribing for it, told him it had essentially disappeared. So Tempati was doubly surprised to receive a letter from Linda Marks's office at the Consumer Protection Branch of the U.S. Department of Justice, suggesting that his work for the network had been illegal. He engaged a lawyer to respond, but wasn't overly concerned. "I was under the impression that it was more like, 'Help us, we are investigating this guy that has these other things going on,'" he said. After all, he had been the one trying to convince Rx Limited that they needed to add video technology so that doctors could see patients virtually. Tempati's lawyer responded that the doctor didn't believe he had done anything illegal, and that he was willing to come to Washington and sit down with the attorneys. For a while, that seemed like the end of it. Then, on the morning of March 27th, Tempati had just completed a 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift at the hospital, and was planning to head home and grab a few hours of sleep before heading off to one of his clinics. As he pulled his car into the driveway, he failed to notice a pair of sedans parked near the end of it. He went upstairs to change clothes and was standing in his thermal underwear when he heard a voice say, "Don't move." A team of 10 officers had arrived, guns drawn, to make the arrest. The agents told Tempati that they had a warrant and went room to room, grabbing files and computers. Tempati's wife stood by, calmly praying, and then turned to their 4-year-old daughter to comfort her. She didn't know what was going on or who these people were, Tempati said. Once they put their guns away, the agents were polite and professional. They agreed to let Tempati walk to the car without handcuffs, suggesting that he tell his neighbors it had been a case of mistaken identity. They then took him to the local police station, where he was strip-searched and fingerprinted, and transported to a federal processing center in downtown Philadelphia. Only later would he learn that he was to be tried not in Pennsylvania, but in Minnesota. Adam Semia, the trigger man Hunter had brought in to kill Catherine Lee, was, like many of LaRue's former employees, oblivious to LaRue's fate. He'd only ever communicated with the boss through Hunter, and after Hunter had accused him of botching the last job in the Philippines, he didn't expect to hear from either of them again. Since 2012, Semia had been back in Roxboro, North Carolina, working on his custom gun holster business with David Stilwell, as if the Manila trip had never happened. Then on November 20th, 2013, a former colleague from the company named John O'Donohue started a chat with Semia on Facebook. "O'Donohue, you hear about Tim and Joe?" Semia: "No, what happened?" O'Donohue: "Read this." O'Donohue then included a link to a press release from the Department of Justice. Semia: "Wow, holy shit." O'Donohue: "That is crazy stuff." Semia: "Very stupid people. They are done. They will never get out." O'Donohue: "Yeah, I would imagine not. I can't believe that they are that sloppy." Semia: "They got blinded by greed." Almost a year later, in September 2014, when Semia and O'Donohue chatted again, O'Donohue had figured out that it was LaRue who had flipped and was taking people down with him. Semia: "Bro, how are you doing? Anything new? I'm going crazy, need to get back out." O'Donohue: "Nothing going on. Lachlan indicted by the feds and will be arrested soon." Semia: What, for what? O'Donohue, stuff he did for LaRue. Samia, what the fuck? How many years ago was that from? O'Donohue, does not matter. Samia, did LaRue get popped too? O'Donohue, got lifted by the feds in Brazil in 2012 and sang like a canary and set all his guys up. Samia, wow. Scary shit, dude. O'Donohue, so far there have been 10 guys who worked for him lifted in different countries and extradited to the U.S. Samia, wow, holy shit. That is fucking BS. That's too bad for Lachlan, he's a good guy. O'Donohue, he's in a bad way at the moment. Samia, have they picked him up yet? O'Donohue, not yet. Samia, wonder if we are going to get brought into this shit. O'Donohue, no. They were all involved in drugs and taken down by the DEA. Samia, dumb, I would never fuck around with that shit. O'Donohue, they got greedy and stupid. 3 months later, on December 20th, 2014, the New York Times revealed to the world what O'Donohue and others on the inside had figured out. Paul LaRue was in the custody of the DEA, and for the previous year, he'd been working to bring down his own organization. Samia and Stillwell's turn to get brought into this shit wouldn't arrive until 7 months later, on the morning of July 22, 2015. Stillwell was out picking up some supplies for new holsters at the hardware store. On the way to his office, he was pulled over by a local sheriff and arrested. When the sheriff brought him to the county lockup, he was placed in an interrogation room. Samia was already at the station, having been lured with a question about his gun permits. Two federal agents stepped into the room with Stillwell and introduced themselves as Special Agents Eric Stouch and Thomas Sindrick from the DEA. We work for the Special Operations Division out of Virginia, Stouch said, and were assigned to work investigations primarily overseas. For several years now, we've been conducting an investigation that led us to you. They read Stillwell his rights, and after he declined to ask for a lawyer, began asking questions about his 2012 trip to the Philippines. At first, Stillwell claimed to be shocked by their insinuations, saying he'd only traveled to Manila, his first trip out of the country, to unwind with Samia. But gradually the agents began to tell him drips of what they knew, and what they claimed Samia had already told them. David, Stouch said, I understand you're kind of blown away by the circumstances right now. Take a deep breath here, all right? You're a professional. You make holsters. You do it well. We're professionals. We do our jobs well. It's not a coincidence that Adam's in here today, and you're in here. We've come to you for a particular reason, but I think there's some saving grace here with your situation. I don't know, Tom, what do you think? I think there is, because I don't think you pulled the trigger, Sindrick said. They told Stillwell they'd been examining his emails, his bank records, his travel receipts. They knew he was there when Lee was killed, Stouch said, but we don't think you really liked it. As the minutes passed, Stillwell repeatedly told the agents that he couldn't recall the events in Manila. No, I get that, Sindrick said, I get that. My problem is, I don't really believe you, and I'll tell you why. Okay. Because there are significant events of people's lives, and one is watching another man pull out a gun and shoot somebody in the face, twice. After an hour and a half of back and forth, Stillwell's resistance slowly began to fade, as Sindrick patiently ground him down. Did Adam Samia pull the trigger on that woman, he finally asked. Yes. Were you present? Yes. Did it happen in the van? It was in the vehicle. Who was driving the vehicle? I was driving. Were you shocked that he pulled the trigger? Yeah, said Stillwell. Samia, for his part, would admit only that he'd known Hunter. I've worked with him in the past, yes, he said, doing security work. The jobs consisted of buying and securing gold in Africa to be shipped to Hong Kong and Dubai. His 2012 trip to the Philippines had just been for some advance work, he said. He was flabbergasted by the charges. I've met these people, yes. I've worked with them in the past, but I did nothing, ever, illegal, he went on. My brother's in law enforcement. All my family is in law enforcement. I've never done nothing wrong. The agents quickly piled up circumstantial evidence alongside Stillwell's admissions. At Samia's house, they found a camera that contained surveillance photos of Catherine Lee's workplace, along with itineraries from the Philippines trip, and a keychain holding what appeared to be a key to a Toyota Innova van. On a camera of Stillwell's, they found photographs dated February 12, 2012, the day that Catherine Lee was murdered. According to court filings, the photos appeared to depict, among other things, a white van similar to the one in which, according to witness accounts, Lee was murdered, and a wounded human head. And on a small notebook found in Samia's bedroom, they'd noticed that he'd written down, Mr. LaRue, Paul Calder. The fat man, That's what we called him, Lachlan McConnell said. He was sitting across from me in December 2015 at a Starbucks outside of a mall in Makati City, Manila. A few days earlier, when I'd finally gotten a hold of him, he'd selected this spot for our meeting. I'd been surprised that I ever heard back from McConnell, having tried without luck to contact him several times before arriving in the country. His name turned up on the website for a security contractor in Manila that listed him on its staff. I had started to assume that the listing was dated. It seemed far-fetched that McConnell would be operating out in the open in the Philippines, while a fugitive from an indictment in the United States. But one afternoon, I decided to drop by the company's office anyway. I left my business card with the receptionist. Later that day, my phone rang. "I'm reluctant to talk on the phone," McConnell said. "There's certain things going on right now, which directly relate to my welfare." He was doing contract work on another Philippine island, but we could meet when he returned. "Literally, there is nothing we can put in writing," he continued. "It will put me in a situation where it will endanger me." He arrived at the appointed hour, a white guy with thinning hair and a polo shirt with folded reading glasses hanging from its open collar. "People are still really scared because there's a strong belief that there are operations still going on," he said. "Money talks in this country. For 5,000 pesos, around $100, you could have someone taken out." He lit a cigarette, the first of several, and dropped the pack on the table. His own concerns were largely legal. He was facing 35 federal criminal counts in the United States for setting up companies and shipping accounts connected to RX Limited. For the next hour, McConnell recounted his story, from his hiring by Dave Smith to the gold schemes in Hong Kong and the missions in Zimbabwe, to Smith's murder and LaRue's threats at the Hard Rock Cafe, to his new duties in Florida and his mental